Hello, and welcome to Power Pros Podcast, Episode 18, The Destruction of Spondylus. I am one of your hosts, the Hoff, Chris Hoffman, and with me is my friend and colleague, Chris Slate.
Hello!
We are back to talk more about Nintendo news, including Animal Crossing and Mario, and our big topic this week is going to be some of Nintendo's greatest innovations. But we'll kick it off first with the news. So our first news topic of discussion is the recent release of Animal Crossing Happy Home Designer on the Nintendo 3DS. Just came out this past Friday, offers up a new Animal Crossing experience, and I haven't actually had a chance to play the game much, but you, Mr. Slate, you have had a chance to play it, and I know your family has been playing it as well.
Yeah, and that's mainly the reason that I got it, actually, is because both my wife and especially my little girl are big fans of the series. And I was a huge fan of the GameCube title, and I've played all of them, but I played like hundreds of hours on the GameCube game. So ever since then, I haven't quite caught the fever again. Mm-hmm. So because of that, I was really curious about this one. You know, they finally tried something a bit different here.
Yeah, that's been the problem with the series, is that it tends to be very samey each time out.
Yeah.
But yeah, this time it's, you know, very specifically about being a home designer.
So. Yeah, and obviously it's a side game. I mean, there will be, your more traditional, Animal Crossing sequel at some point in the future. They've said that.
Oh, yeah.
But as a nice little diversion, I thought it seems pretty cool from the little bit I've played and from what I've seen and heard from my family playing. It kind of is what it is. I mean, if you want the kind of richer, meatier, more full-bodied, to continue my food and drink analogies, Animal Crossing experience, then it might not entirely scratch that itch. I mean, you'll have to wait for the full version, full next version. But if you're into it primarily for decorating and collecting all the furniture and the items and the home designing, you might actually like it better. My family actually did like it better. I mean, the monetary restrictions are off. You don't owe Tom Nook a dime in this game.
Oh, wow.
In fact, you work for...
totally changing it up.
Yeah. You work in like your own little office in town. You have an office in town, but you live out of town. So that's a difference. You don't own house in here that you have to pay him for. Exactly. People pay you, presumably. I don't know if that's actually true in the game. I think maybe you just do these as like great grand favors. But you're in your little office and people pop by and they're like, I'd like a house with this or that. Or especially at the beginning, they have a lot of public works. So you have to go in and you have to help design schools and different, kind of city locations. And that actually, you run through that pretty quickly. And I remember my daughter came in just after like a day of playing and said, well, that's disappointing. The credits are rolling already.
Huh.
And I was like, well, that can't be right. I know there's at least 400 Amiibo cards for this. You've got to have lots to do. Mm-hmm. And it just turned out that I guess...
She's just really, really good at the game. That's what you found out.
Yeah, she's a real prodigy at this game. But I guess what happens is when you get through with the stuff, the only things that the game kind of says you have to do, which is kind of get the town up and running, then technically it's not over, but you've kind of, you're done with the kind of basically the only core objectives. And then from mm-hmm. then on out, it's just, play as many hundreds of hours, I guess, as you want, just decorating or redecorating all these houses.
And so the random villagers just show up and make your make requests from then on?
Yeah, I mean, from the little bit that I played, my wife and my daughter hogged the game all weekend, and I got in like 30 minutes right before the day before this podcast, just so I could speak about it a little bit more intelligently. And but you come out of your office, and it seems that people are just sitting there waiting for you to approach them, and then they'll ask you to do something. Or if you want, you can pick up the Amiibo phone in your office, and that's your cue to use the NFC functionality with the new Amiibo cards.
Right, well, I'd like to get to that in a second, but first mm-hmm. I'm wondering, is there any sort of challenge involved? Do you get rewarded in any way for making a good design versus a bad design or anything like that?
Well, I mean, I really should have my family in here to talk about it. One of it seems to me is that the only thing that I got from the house that I decorated was an emotion. And similar to some past Animal Crossing games, you can collect these different kind of faces you can select and wear. And apparently there's a ton of them. So I think the one I got was, he liked the house, and it was all positive, but the emotion I got was heartbreak, which is kind of sad. I learned heartbreak from a job well done, apparently. So there's that, and also just the joy of kind of interacting with all your favorite Animal Crossing critters, taking photos with them after you've, built up their houses, decorated their front lawns as well. Okay. So it isn't just like you're always inside doing stuff. I mean, you're decorating the outside, you're walking around, You've got a little chunk of town to go through. So it's not nearly as limiting as I felt like it would be when the game was first announced. It's obviously not a full-fledged game like we were saying before, but there's quite a bit to it. If primarily you just want to get the game because you like essentially, you know, playing Dollhouse and decorating things up, then this is kind of the ultimate version of that. And they've actually kind of improved the mechanisms by which you actually decorate a room, because now you can much more easily use a map on the bottom screen of the 3DS to kind of drag and drop and turn items. And,
oh, that's convenient.
And yeah, it's on a grid. So it's much easier and much more fun to kind of lay a room out. And so hopefully they carry over what they learned with this game back into the main series.
Okay, yeah. So how about that NFC and Amiibo cards?
Well, I got the full-on bundle that comes with the NFC, kind of like a little white hockey puck. Mm-hmm. The game came with one card. I got Mr. Rossetti. I'm not sure if everyone gets the same card or if it's always different. Mm-hmm. By the way, Mr. Rossetti was the only card of like the 25-something I bought on launch day that also unlocked a sprite character or costume in Mario Maker
for those that are curious.
Yeah. And so yeah, I think it works pretty well. It's a novelty. It seems like there's no shortage of creators in the game without cards that will come up that you can interact with. But I guess the cards are primarily if you really want to interact with your favorite ones. This is kind of a shortcut to doing so. Mm-hmm. And there's 100 cards in the first set. There'll be 400 when all is said and done, I think. They're essentially a buck a piece. So yeah. My only beef with it really is in kind of the how much they're charging for all this, because I think using the cards is fine. It's cool, and it's a neat little thing to collect, although the cards don't serve any other purpose other than unlocking things. Unlike, you know, Amiibo figurines, which are just great to kind of enjoy, put on your shelf and display, the cards are, something you stack up and hide away. It's not like you can play like a Magic the Gathering or Pokemon-style game with them.
You can't with the regular Amiibos either. But, I mean, I guess if you're a fan, you sort of like the art style or something that has that aspect of collectability to it. But
maybe. It could just be personal preference.
Yeah, it doesn't have a lot of appeal to me.
But it's essentially a buck a card. So even if you never got any doubles of cards, you'd be spending, you know, not counting tax, you know, $100 on the first set.
You're not counting that free one you got.
Bucks when it's all said and done. Yeah, okay. So your $1, Nintendo covers you for $1. So, I just don't think, you know, it's so common to just, I mean, there's nothing truly special about what they unlock in the game. It's kind of any character asking you for help at their home seems to be a dime a dozen.
But some of the cards are like, you know, special sort of, you know, shiny and glittery. Is there anything special about those cards in the game?
If there is in the game, then I don't know what it is yet.
I mean, it seems like they're just sort of the more popular common characters that show up in the games more frequently rather than just, you know, the random villagers.
Yeah, for sure. And you get one of those per pack of six.
But other than that, nothing.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, personally, I feel like it's all, again, not counting how much it all costs, I think it's fine. It's neat. It adds something to the game.
But when you do take into what it costs.
I feel like this stuff should cost at least half as much as it actually does. And from the perspective of someone who, like, I don't collect any kind of trading card games. So maybe it's a fair market price if you're into that kind of stuff. But looking at it as DLC, essentially, that's being blind bagged, you're going to end up paying way more than 100 or even $400 for the full set, because you're going to get tons of doubles. You better hope you've got friends who are collecting them too, or just get used to going onto eBay to find the ones you don't have. It just seems like if you're just going to dabble in it, fine. It's all good. It's not going to be that much money to buy a couple packs. If you're serious about collecting them, and I would have been, because I've collected every Amiibo figurine, and I'm pretty hardcore about Amiibo, and this is technically still Amiibo.
Yes.
But this is where I draw the line. I can't go in for that much money, especially when I don't even know what I'm going to get when I buy it.
Yeah, I mean, I'm certainly not going to get into this. I suppose if I, you know, get the other Animal Crossing Amiibo Festival game, I think that comes with some free cards. I'll have a couple there. But yeah, this just seems, I mean, I hate to use the word, but it seems like a huge ripoff.
I think so. And again, if the rest of the card market, you know, is along these similar lines from what they charge and stuff, then I feel like all of it's a ripoff. You know, the cards are cute. There isn't anything that special about them other than that one per pack that you said has a little bit of extra foil and stuff on it. Otherwise, they just seem like basic paper plain trading cards. And the NFC chip that's inside them is like a...
Have you seen that thing? It's minuscule.
Yeah, if there's pictures online of people who have dared to rip them open. They're just tiny little dots. I don't know how you justify charging a buck a card for these things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, that's, you know, I suppose kind of what I expected, but it's kind of too bad to hear that, you know, it's not something more substantial. Or maybe it's good that it's not more substantial because then you'd want to spend $400 or $1,000 or whatever it would end up costing to get all those things.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I mean, it's kind of weird that one of the reasons they said they were going to do cards is like, oh, we're going to make this a more affordable way to collect, you know, some Amiibo-type collectibles. But it ended up being, you know, sort of the opposite. It's like they're blind bagged. There's a zillion of them. There's no way you'll ever catch them all.
Yeah. I mean, if they were applying cards to something like Smash Brothers and a $1 card could unlock, you know, a character instead of paying the what is it, $2 or $3, $4 for somebody like Rue, but they've created their – it's not apples and oranges here, or it is apples and oranges. They've created their whole other thing here where there's now such a huge volume of this mm-hmm. stuff that, again, if you're trying to collect it all, they're really going to put you through hell on this one. Mm-hmm. But I don't want to be too sour. Back to the game itself, it does seem like a pretty good game, especially for the audience that just loves to – you know, the home decorating portion of the series.
Well, moving on from that game and these Amiibo cards, I'd like to talk about our favorite news topic, which is just regular old Amiibo.
Amiibo!
Specifically, there was the Retro 3 pack that just came out this past Friday. You and I went out to the store together, and I picked up mine. You did not pick up yours at the time because you foolishly pre-ordered at a distant location and just had to stand there and watch while I prayed around the office with these three Amiibo, Duck Hunt Dog and Mr. Game & Watch and Rob. And, you know, you just stood there jealously.
I was sweating it all day. I was afraid that even though I'd put my $5 down, the GameStop near my house was going to give it away.
But you did get it, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it was no trouble. Walked right in, picked it up. And, man, Duck Hunt Dog was always the Amiibo that I pointed to and said, this just proves that you never know what Nintendo's going to do. I never would have in a million years, you know, even a year or two ago, thought I would have a Nintendo-made toy of Duck Hunt Dog.
Yeah, I know. It's pretty crazy when you think of it that way. Did he end up being your favorite, though?
I think so. I think so. I think Rob is a really well-done figure, and I love the detailing on it. His arms mm-hmm. even seem to have a metallic sheen. I guess I'm just used to seeing Rob in a lot of stuff. You know, he's been, you know, in Mario Kart 7 and Smash, the last couple of Smash games, obviously.
Oh, yeah, but you didn't have Amiibos of him then.
No, I mean, he's totally cool, but if I had to pick my favorite, I guess it's Duck Hunt Dog just because I've only seen him in Smash, and I'm still kind of not over the shock that he came back in any kind of capacity. I've got a 5-year-old boy who, for some reason, was really taken with Mr. Game & Watch while he watched me play Smash Brothers, mm-hmm. and he's really been looking forward to this coming out, and he was playing with that Amiibo all weekend, just, in, you know, pulling out the different poses that it comes with, mm-hmm. You know, switching them out, playing with them together. And so that was fun to see him having such a good time with them.
Yeah, I think Rob is my favorite just because of the detail on him. Probably next is Duck Hunt Dog because, again, it's, you know, such an obscure character to get, something we never thought we would have a collectible of if it weren't for Smash and the Amiibo. And then after that, Mr. Game & Watch, just because it's so simple. But the fact that you got four different poses, you know, makes him a really, really cool figure as well. So, yeah, they're all winners. I think it was money well spent.
I will say that taken as far as if you count the three of them as like their own little wave, it's one of my favorite, mm-hmm. Waves so far.
Yeah. Yeah, I just wish there was a way to display the other Mr. Game & Watches.
I know.
Have a whole little Mr. Game & Watch army there.
It is tough. All the different poses look so good. It's tough picking just one, you know, to put on the shelf.
Which one did you put on your shelf? Just the default?
It's whatever one my son has left in the base at the moment. Uh-huh. If I was really focusing on it, right now my Amiibo are in like just a top shelf of a bookcase. I really got to come up with some nicer display. But when the day comes that I do really pretty them up, I'll probably pick the one where he's ringing the bell. Just because that's his cool little taunt. I always like that.
It's a fine choice. Well, we got those, but I also happened to pick up the modern Pixel Mario Amiibo. You know, there's still no word on what's going on with that one in the U.S., other than that it's bundled with the Wii system and Mario Maker exclusively at Walmart. And I figured that by now, you know, he would be made available to everybody since it was supposed to have, you know, like an official September release. And I thought that meant, you know, something you could actually go out and buy if you're already a Nintendo system owner. But yeah, it's been a couple weeks. There's still no sign of him. I'm like, you know what? Screw that. I'm not going to fall for this ploy, Nintendo. If you don't want my money to buy one of these things, I'm just going to import him. So I did, and I really like it. I would say I do like it better than the retro one. I think that the extra colors just bring out a lot more in the figure. Specifically, we've got, he has like these buttons on his outfit. And they both do. The retro one does. The modern one does. But on the retro one, you know, they're brown. They're the same color as his flesh. And it's kind of like, you know, are these buttons or are they his nipples sticking out of his outfit or what? And then he's got like the same thing on his hat. There's like a brown spot right in the middle of his hat that I guess was supposed to represent, you know, the M. But, you know, you can't really tell because it's just a pixel. And it's like, is that just a hole in his hat? You can see part of his head sticking through. But, you know, they have those actually colored properly. It's white on the modern one and the buttons are yellow. So it's not Mario's nipples, unless his nipples are yellow. And, of course, he's got the white gloves on. So it's I like it better than the pixel one. But, of course, they're both really, really cool to have. I took some photos of them together. And yeah, it's a nice little pairing.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to getting that version. I think that'll be my favorite version as well. You know, hopefully Nintendo does announce it individually for sale in the U.S. before too long.
I'm sure they will, but I'm just surprised it hasn't happened yet. I really wish they would make a Luigi to go with them, though, because, you know, that really, you know, stirs up my fiery retro blood.
Yeah, well, it is Super Mario Brothers. Not Super Luigi Brothers.
It's Super Mario Brothers.
Yeah, Brothers is second billing.
But in other pseudo amiibo news, you were with me at the store and we were checking out the new Skylanders stuff. And there's Bowser, there's Donkey Kong, and they aren't just Skylanders characters; they're also amiibo. And I did not walk away terribly impressed.
It made me feel better about deciding not to get them, to be honest. Technically, I guess they're kind of half amiibo because there's a little switch on the bottom. Like you said, they can operate in either style. But just because the amiibo kind of logo is on the box, I felt like as a crazy, you know, completionist for amiibo. Do I need to get these? And I decided it wasn't worth paying all that money to get the starter kits and all
that. Yeah, you have to get them as a bundle. It's like $70. Not as bad as $300 for Pixel Mario, but... You know,
yeah, and if I go for the standard versions, then I guess I got to get the what are the other versions called? The black versions, the black and white versions.
Oh, I don't remember, but yeah, those cost like $100. And
yeah, but then we looked at the quality of these things, and the eyes were all kind of weird.
They were not the best quality. I mean, first I was looking at Donkey Kong, and the quality on him wasn't so bad, but he has such a silly outfit. He's got like it looks to me like a total disco outfit. Like he's wearing this 70s bright yellow disco suit. It's just hilarious. And, you know, I think he's borrowing Funky Kong's clothes. There's no question about that. And then the Bowser, yeah, just had really awful paint jobs. Like, I'm not even sure how it's really supposed to look. I think one eye is supposed to be, you know, sort of bigger than the other. But, like, I guess it would be his left eye, like, was just so inconsistent. Like, sometimes it was looking off to the left, sometimes it was looking off to the right. One time I saw one, it was like almost off his eyeball, like on his cheek. Huh. It was really disturbing. But it's like all the different Bowsers just looked really sort of derpy.
I don't know if
he's cross-eyed and looking the wrong ways. His eye just wouldn't look the same way most of the time.
I don't know if
really
we just
silly.
Came across a bad batch. I mean, I haven't collected Skylanders figures before, but having gotten used to the high quality of amiibo, It didn't represent Skylanders very well. That the first time I really scrutinized their figures, it was kind of that.
I mean, it's not even close when you compare the quality between a regular amiibo and these guys. And even when I found one where I thought the eyes, you know, almost looked okay on Bowser, then I'm like, oh, but you know, the paint on like his fingernails, you know, the white doesn't really cover everywhere it should. I looked at the red on his hammer, and like, oh, that doesn't seem to quite go to, you know, where it should either. So it really gives me a brand new appreciation for how great all the Nintendo amiibo are.
Yeah, Nintendo's doing a crazy good job with those.
And I guess we should also mention that, in addition to the new Skylanders being out, LEGO Dimensions came out, you know, if you're into the whole Toys to Life category. I didn't pick the game up or anything, and of course there are no, you know, Nintendo-specific characters, but it is out on Wii U. And, you know, it was cool to see all that stuff, all those different universes coming together. And, you know, if you're into that, you probably already know, you probably already dropped a whole bunch of money on it. You know what else also came out recently and is pretty darn cool?
What's that?
the new Nintendo 3DS. As you're aware, it was there was a bundle, and that included the aforementioned Animal Crossing Happy Home Designer. But this is the smaller version, with the colored buttons, and it was only released in Japan, and now it's finally out as part of that bundle. And we talked about this when they first announced it a few weeks ago. But we're like, is there going to be anything beyond this? Is there going to be, a separate non-Animal Crossing version? We still don't know the answer to that. But Nintendo did start selling faceplates on its website.
Right. And that's a website a lot of people may not know even exists. But you can order parts and systems, basic hardware stuff, specifically from Nintendo's U.S. Website.
Yeah, I think it's store.nintendo.com. Mm. And they had a whole bunch of them. They had several themed ones. They had a Zelda one with the Hylian crest and a bunch of Triforces. There's a Kirby one. There's a Smash Brothers one, a really cool Smash Brothers one that has silver outlines of the characters. There's a Mario mushroom. There's a Pikachu one. Then there's some that are just designs and colors like camouflage. I think there's a pink one. I think there were 10, or at least there were 10 when I checked this morning that have been there. And, even though I don't have the system yet, I ordered a Zelda one, just in case. Just in case, can't be too careful with that stuff.
That's cool, because I don't get the sense yet that this version of the system will ever be in any especially wide release. So I can't imagine they're going to, GameStop or the other chains would spend a lot of shelf space on faceplates. Mm-hmm. But this is a way Nintendo can, constantly have stock up, on their own site, and for the consumers that do really want that kind of stuff, have it for them.
Yeah, I mean, switchable faceplates was supposed to be a big part of the Game Boy Micro, and that never ended up happening, other than the ones that were bundled with it. But it's cool to see that this, even though it's only sort of a minor release of a system in this bundle, that they're making these options available to North American consumers without having to import the stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, it's cool. I like it. Have you been continuing to play Mario Maker?
Yeah, way too much. Still not getting enough sleep because of Mario Maker. And I've only uploaded 3 levels so far, but as you well know, I keep polishing them, resubmitting them, and then asking you to test them again.
Yes, that keeps happening. It's true.
But it's pretty awesome. And one thing, a bit of news that I guess we missed that I was telling you about the other day, I guess Famitsu, the long-running, most popular video game magazine in Japan, they have a mascot character, Neki the Fox, appears on all of their illustrated covers. And I guess they had announced and even shown screens of the fact that you'll be able to get a Neki the Fox costume, sprite to use in Mario Maker, just like you use the Amiibo sprites for other characters. So I guess this is proof that DLC is coming. At the very least, that bit of presumably free DLC. I don't know if that's going to be available all over the world or just in Japan, but it would be weird. I mean, people here obviously don't know Neki the Fox, but it would be weird if we're playing Japanese Japanese levels from Japanese creators and we're seeing that costume and we don't have the option to put them in our own levels here.
Yeah, that would be odd, especially since, you can, save other people's levels and then edit them. So, it sort of seems like we would get it, for just those reasons alone.
Maybe there'll be a batch of new DLC and or new costumes, and he'll just kind of be thrown in there so that even if we're not familiar with him, we'll just say, oh, it's like a cutesy version of Fox Mario, because he's actually wearing Mario's costume.
That's true. It's true.
Yeah. So that's pretty cool, and hopefully that means a lot more DLC. I'd still really love to see Slopes in there and some of the other missing elements.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'd like to see some more costumes. The frog costume, the Hammer Brothers costume, that would all be great. Maybe a cat suit.
Yeah.
I guess the cat suit's only been in, Mario 3D World, but still, why not?
It's pretty distinctive. I think that the cat suit will stick around. Some of the suits come and go, and some of the ones you remember and then get brought back in other games. I think cat suit will stick around.
I also like to see the ice flower.
Yeah?
I think that could be fun. It could make some really creative design possibilities. And maybe you could finally have a way to take down those stupid cheap cheeps. From hell.
This fiery castle cheap cheeps.
Yeah. Cheapest of cheap cheeps.
And the thing about adding stuff in this game is it shouldn't impact levels that existed already, because they just won't have those elements in them.
Right.
So, bring it on. But speaking of levels and speaking of all the time I've put into making levels, we gave away some codes for one of your stages last time. Mm-hmm. And I'd like to go ahead and throw one out there. And I think you might have a new level, too, you'd like to share.
Sure. We've been putting these out over the Twitter. But, yeah, we might as well share them here as well.
Yeah, just really quick. This one's for a level that I'm particularly proud of, at least the idea behind it. You have to keep a giant Koopa Troopa alive all the way to the end. So
it's
you
an
can,
escort mission.
It's exactly. It's an escort mission. You have to keep him alive all the way in to the end, work as partners to get through different obstacles. So if you'd like to check that out really quick, the code is 65E700000077A6A9. And if jotting stuff down from a podcast isn't the most convenient thing ever, like Hoff said, all this stuff will be on the Power Pros Twitter, at Power Pros, so check them out. And then, Hoff, you've got a new one.
Yeah, well, not new. It's been up for at least a week, but I haven't talked about it on the podcast before. It is an airship level that I've called Flying Fortress, and the code for that is 74F80000. 00453 0D0. So if you guys want to check those out, that would be awesome.
Yeah, we'd appreciate it. Of course, like everybody else playing that game, we're looking for our numbers to go up, hoping to get some stars if people dig them and get more medals and all that good stuff. But I promise I'm not going to put anything up that I don't think is worth your time.
There was one other bit of news that we just found out about today, and that is that Mario Tennis Ultra Smash finally has a release date. We're not getting Star Fox in November, but we are getting Mario Tennis. It is coming on November 20th.
That's one of those games that I'll probably buy, but I'm not super excited about. But then I forget about it for a while, and I'm reminded it's coming out, and it's kind of like a pleasant surprise.
Yeah, I wasn't super impressed with it at E3. It just sort of seemed like, oh, here's your typical Mario Tennis game. I really wish they would make these more robust modes that people really liked in the older handheld Nintendo sports titles, and make like a full-fledged RPG mode and stuff like that, and make something people could really get behind and spend a lot of time with and really, really enjoy, and still have fun with the Mario characters, not be forced to play. I'm just going to play with my custom Mii or something, wearing Mario's pants, like I think they did on the 3DS version or whatever. But yeah, go all out. It seems like they never want to do that. And again, I haven't seen the since E3, so for all I know, they've had way more. It's not just your typical tennis, but I haven't seen anything to evidence to say that they have done that either. So.
Yeah, the E3 demo is very limited. It essentially just focused on, look, you can get the Mega Mushroom to turn big.
Yep, yep.
And they just kept spitting those at you.
Uh-huh.
So we'll see what it does. I mean, I share the same concerns with both this series and Mario Golf. I feel like it's just become too kind of arcadey. In that the basic core mechanics are a lot of fun, but I've played them so many times, you really got to get me a reason or several reasons to dig in and kind of put some serious time into
these
games.
It's not like
Mario
Kart where they're giving us new courses and stuff. The tennis, every time it's tennis.
Yeah, and I think on Wii they just thought, well, party games are big. This is enough. But now we really need something to sink our teeth into, I think.
All right. Well, I think we are going to talk about Nintendo innovations in just a minute. In fact, we're going to talk about innovations on the Nintendo 64 specifically. But first, we're going to take a little intermission with some music. Okay, we're back, and we are here to talk about some of Nintendo's greatest innovations, specifically from the Nintendo 64 era. We just passed an anniversary of the Nintendo 64, but we're going to try to not go crazy with the anniversary madness like we sometimes do. But it did get us thinking that there's lots of really cool stuff that originated from that era, and a lot of what we take for granted as being, common mainstays of video games, not just Nintendo games, but across the board, every console manufacturer and software manufacturer borrowed a lot of these Nintendo innovations to make video gaming what it is today.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, when you think back on the N64, and this is something we noticed when we worked on Nintendo Power, is a lot of the letters that came in from readers seemed to be from readers who kind of first came to Nintendo gaming through the N64.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
And it was obviously, it was a milestone console. I mean, it was right there with the PlayStation and the generation that shifted us away from only playing with 2D sprite-based games into 3D polygonal titles.
Mm-hmm.
And nothing was more influential in that than Super Mario 64.
Yeah.
You think about it, and the best comparison I can come up with is until we had Mario 64, 3D platforming or like just playing a game in a 3D environment was essentially defined by Bubsy 3D on the PlayStation.
Well, I know that Tomb Raider was out before then. We're playing, you know, Tomb Raider, I think, on the Saturn, but it tended to be, you know, very stiff, you know, very tank-like. You remember that from, you know, stuff like Resident Evil and Tomb Raider, and didn't really have the ability to be, you know, fluid like Mario is. And I guess Bubsy was kind of the same. We didn't have the tank controls also. I don't know. I never played that crap.
I believe it did have something like that. It was very much a workman-like approach to it, and it obviously wasn't there. It was like a first pass at 3D gaming that was significant and fun at the time because it was so new. But when Mario 64 came around, it really showed how far behind those titles were. It became basically the blueprint for not just, you know, platforming in 3D, but for 3D gaming in general. And mm-hmm. You look back on it now and you can see how rough the camera was.
We've talked about some problems with it before.
Yeah, but it at the time, every kind of bit of that game, every little, you know, speck of it was revolutionary.
Mm-hmm. But I think that, you know, it wouldn't have worked with just the software alone. It was tied so closely to the hardware. And specifically, I mean the fact that, you know, the default controller for the system had an analog stick.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's what made controlling him in 3D and, you know, controlling, you know, subsequent heroes in 3D, you know, whether it's Link or Banjo or Conker or whatever, you know, so smooth and so much fun. If it didn't have that built in, I think you might have been, you know, you would have been really stuck. I think that's why games like Tomb Raider had those tank controls, because when you're talking digital movement, in a 3D space, you are cut off from some options.
That's right. And in the PlayStation, you know, I love the first PlayStation. They did a lot of things right, and they made some very key smart decisions that Nintendo didn't in terms of, like, the form of media they took and things mm-hmm. like that. But you could even see after the PlayStation launched how much it was influenced by the N64, because it didn't launch, like you said, with an analog stick. It had a digital-only pad. It didn't even have rumble in the controller.
Yeah, that's the other thing, is that was introduced in Star Fox 64 with the rumble pack.
That's right. They came bundled together.
Mm-hmm.
So that was yet another N64 kind of innovation as far as bringing it to a mass audience. And then you saw PlayStation and others follow. You know, they came up with their own analog stick. And I still remember, maybe I'm wrong in my memory, but I remember an analog stick for the PlayStation that didn't even have rumble in it. And I remember the DualShock, where they introduced rumble and analog control, came mm-hmm. even after that. So
that's the first one I remember. That one stands out really well to me. But, you know, I was not working at PlayStation Magazine at the time.
Yeah.
Like you were.
Maybe
so
it was a prototype or something, but I feel like
was
that existed.
Could it be Japan only or something like that?
It's possible. My memory can be so fuzzy about those things. But regardless, it was clear that Nintendo was setting the trend once again with that
controller.
Yeah,
the other companies were still, you know, taking a look and seeing what Nintendo was doing. And even though Sony was on top of the mountain, they were like, yeah, we're still going to copy what Nintendo is doing.
Yeah, and I loved, even just pulling Mario 64 out of the box for the first time, I remember just, you know, goofing around forever just outside the castle before even going in and playing a proper level.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Just pressing that analog stick, you know, in increments and going from like a slow kind of crawl to a walk to a trot to a jog to a run, and just how revolutionary that felt, that I had such an amazing one-to-one kind of connection with that character. And the game really played it up. It feels like today, the actual maneuvering with analog stick isn't a challenge, partly because we're used to it. But I remember even going back now and playing Mario 64, some of the challenges are specifically like, can you stay on this, walk across this narrow beam using analog mm-hmm. controls? So the game really highlighted and really trained you to use that feature.
Man, that stuff is kind of tough, even now. I can't say I've ever really loved the whole analog nature of moving slower or faster, but just having that complete 360 degrees of movement, that was what, you know, that's what's really, really key.
Yeah, yeah. And there was some stuff in Mario 64 that, looking back on it, was a little extraneous. You might go from like a a walk to a run sometimes, probably not even then. They even had some moves in that game, some attacks and like a sweep kick and stuff that never really, nothing in the game was really patterned off of. But, you know, they were trying out a lot of things with that game, and some of it, didn't quite land, but so much of it did.
Mm-hmm.
And speaking of influential N64 games, following that up, if Mario 64 was kind of like, hey, everybody, here's how we can do polygonal gaming. You need analog controls. You need this kind of camera control. You need this kind of approach. Ocarina of Time came in with the lock-on camera. And mm-hmm. you think about how variations of the lock-on camera, how much of that's used today in every kind of game. And so that was just another amazing breakthrough from an N64 title.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it didn't have the camera control that that Super Mario did. You know, kind of thought maybe you would expand upon that and have complete freedom with the camera. But no, they went a totally different direction and gave you the lock-on camera instead, which made it much, much easier and more enjoyable to have fighting multiple enemies in 3D space.
Yeah, and it's such a beautiful and elegant solution. You're essentially being able to control a character and fight in a 2D plane while still keeping 3D movement throughout the environment.
Mm-hmm.
So it was the best of both worlds. And again, if they hadn't come up with that, maybe someone else would have at some point. But they certainly did it first, and that really, just redefined what gaming should be for that era.
Yeah. It's hard to argue with that point. There are a couple other, really, really important things that system did as well. And for me, the one that really stands out is that it felt like it was the system that cracked how to do a first-person shooter on console. Up until then, it was totally the domain of PCs. And, they had tried stuff before. I think, there was even, Doom on the Super NES or something. Like, crazy? Or they tried that?
Yeah, I think you're right.
But, it was never much of a success. And then, boom, we got GoldenEye, and, everything changed. Like, this is the way that first-person shooters are meant to be done.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and GoldenEye really became the template for first-person shooters from then on out,
mm-hmm.
which was amazing because you didn't think of first-person shooters and consoles really in any kind of serious capacity.
What's even crazier is that these days you don't think of Nintendo and first-person shooters at all. I mean, we have Splatoon, which is third-person, but that was a new thing. If you were thinking back 5 or 10 years, maybe even 15 years, you'd be like, Nintendo and a first-person shooter? That's crazy talk. All they do is Mario and cartoony stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, they were just totally on top of it when it came to that genre. And part of that was tied to the fact that the system had built-in 4 players. And now with wireless controllers and stuff like that, that seems like a no-brainer. It's really common. You can have as many controllers as you want if your game even supports couch co-op. But that was something that the system did, so well. It was like, the party system.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, back then, I remember, if you're, sort of a hardcore gamer, and you're into a wide variety of stuff, you definitely want to have a PlayStation. You're playing, Symphony of the Night. You're playing Final Fantasy, and you're playing Metal Gear. But if you want to have friends over, you gotta have a Nintendo 64.
Yeah, I remember, it seemed like that was the system that everybody that I've talked to said, back in college in our dorm, or, me and my roommate would just always play, GoldenEye or Smash
totally.
Brothers, or even Mario Kart. And it's more for the kids, I guess, was the whole Mario Party series, which kicked mm-hmm. off on the N64.
Oh, no. Don't say that was just for the kids. Man, there were some brutal competitions for the college and older set with that game. I mean, I think all the people that rubbed holes in their hands spinning the joystick around, that I think those were definitely people competing in college, maybe that were playing the Mario drinking party.
Well, another thing that you had along with the analog stick, and especially if we're talking about first-person shooters, is you had that Z trigger underneath. Now, of course, the N64 controller had this weird kind of three-pronged way, and it even came with instructions how you could hold it different ways.
Yeah, that was a really bizarre configuration. I mean, it had so many innovations in the controller. I think the controller was crucial to its success, but the three-prong thing was weird. I always thought it was like, oh, if you're doing really bad in a game and you've humiliated yourself, you just hold it by the side and you just, impale yourself in the belly.
It's like a trident.
Yes.
But holding that middle prong with your finger kind of wrapped, your trigger finger on that kind of Z trigger, I don't know that it necessarily set a new precedent that the whole industry followed, but certainly the more trigger-shaped shoulder buttons that would come later on, and even if you think about the shape and feel of holding the Wii remote and resting your finger on the B trigger, is something that carried on in one way or another.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like it really helped when it comes to the Wii remote. I can definitely feel that influence there, but maybe to a lesser extent to other publishers' hardware. But I can see what you're talking about.
Yeah. So, I just think overall, I don't know, some people super fondly remember the N64. I think looking back on it, it had probably the weakest kind of overall library in terms of for Nintendo gaming, in terms of just a breadth of titles. It was first generation polygonal gaming, so a lot of it didn't age very well. But there are at least a handful of games that are like not just genre defining, but industry defining games. Mm-hmm. And right in step with them are all these kind of hardware innovations, controller innovations that Nintendo brought with that platform.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it really did move things forward a whole bunch. And one of those things we hadn't brought up before is the dedicated C buttons. They're called C buttons because they are camera buttons. And, that ended up, changing. That didn't stick around as far as buttons go. But, that's what ended up becoming, the second analog stick on other controllers. And, it was the C stick on the GameCube. And that ended up being another, it's like basically this is how you control things in 3D is with, this second, set of, whether it's a button or a joystick or whatever it is there. Is you have these buttons dedicated to that camera movement, and that was also crucial. And it's like these days, it's like, duh, of course that's what you got over there.
Yeah.
But, again, with that controller, that key controller, it was, super important in moving games forward.
Yeah. Yeah, and, just look at the history of Nintendo. They've always, they came up with the cross pad. They came up with, shoulder buttons. They came up, obviously, with certain genre-defining games. Just throughout history, time and time again, so many people now, even people that might turn their nose up at Nintendo gaming, probably don't realize just how much of what they play now kind of started or at least was heavily popularized by Nintendo.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true. I mean, if I had to pick, the most important innovation they've done, I would probably say it was changing gaming from, the simple Atari joystick to the gaming control pad.
Yeah.
So that wouldn't be something from N64, but even so, with every generation, they're doing something that's super, super important.
Yeah. Makes me, super curious as always to see, what they're going to do with the NX. And, also one other thing we didn't touch on was obviously motion controls with the Wii generation.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe we'll see if touchscreen gaming sticks around with from the Wii U. But, certainly for better or for worse, Wii brought Waggle into your living room.
I guess this isn't technically an innovation, but, because of what, the decisions that Nintendo made during that time period, they also, completely have, reshaped the landscape of video gaming that has made it what it is today. And, of course, I'm talking about, before they had the N64, they were talking with Sony about, doing a CD-ROM add-on for the Super Nintendo. And, if that had, gone the way it was originally intended to, then we would have ended up with like a Sony-Nintendo partnership. There probably wouldn't have been the standalone PlayStation. And it's like, man, can you even imagine what that would have been like? Sega probably would have still been a contender. Right now, would Sony and Nintendo be partners against Sega and Microsoft or something? It's really weird to think about how that one decision and then choosing to go with cartridges instead for the N64, has totally changed what gaming might have been over the last 20 years.
I know if Nintendo kind of doesn't kick Sony to the curb and back out of that SNES CD-ROM deal, and if Sony doesn't then go off and make their own PlayStation, which they use to really age up the audience, then mm-hmm. does gaming kind of become the thing in our culture that it is today, that it's primarily known as with, high-def, Call of Duty graphics and that kind of stuff? Like you said, is Sega still sticking around making consoles? And if Nintendo doesn't go with cartridges. If they go with discs instead, which was so much more cost effective for third parties, then do they stick with Nintendo instead of going somewhere else? And
yeah, all the third parties, I think, would have stuck around. I mean, they wouldn't have been able to go to Sony because Sony wouldn't have been a thing.
I mean, there have been a lot of decisions and a lot of things in the industry that have had huge ripple effects. But it's hard to think of a more of a bigger turning point in gaming than Nintendo deciding to go cartridges on the N64.
Yeah, although I guess that's kind of a little off what our key topic was supposed to be here. But here's another innovation that you only got on N64: wrapping gorillas.
That's true. I can't believe people haven't copied that.
Yeah. Hopefully someday. Hopefully we'll get that again.
Yeah, maybe in the next Donkey Kong Country.
Can only hope. Well, I think that wraps up our discussion on the Nintendo 64 great innovations. It seems like we ran through that faster than I intended to. I hope I'm not forgetting anything important. But at any rate, we're going to call it a show. But before we go, it's going to be time for a dramatic reading. This time for one of my all-time favorites, the back of the box of Mega Man. It's Mega Man versus the powerful leaders and fighting forces of Monsteropolis, that strange multi-layered land of robot-like humanoids created by the wrongly performed experiments with human beings by Dr. Wily. Jesus. Mega Man, the chosen defender of the human race. For he dares to single-handedly penetrate Monsteropolis' 7 separate societies to stop the rapid expansion of strange misrepresentations of humans. Mega Man's goal is monumental. He must infiltrate 7 separate heavily guarded empires by himself. He must break down and destroy the followers of empire leaders. Cut Man, Guts Man, Ice Man, Bomb Man, Fire Man, Elec Man, and Dr. Wily. The action involves Mega Man, armed only with laser beam weapons, encountering strangely configured humanoids. They're atop, in, and out of fortified prison-like structures, strengthened with thick walls, below ice fields, hidden amid gun turrets embedded in concrete uprights, even in subterranean passages under ice fields. Wow. Will you and Mega Man penetrate the 7 separate societies of Dr. Wily and preserve the human race? You're in control.
Man, I wish I could go back in time and get a gig writing those boxes. It sounded like they just had a blast.
That one is nuts. There's a lot of penetrating and misrepresentations of humans in that one.
It's also funny. You wonder how much they ever knew about the games before they wrote these things.
I would assume nothing.
All right. Well, that's it for this week. As always, you can find us at powerpros.podbean.com, and you can follow us at PowerProsPod on both Facebook and Twitter. You can also follow the Hoff on Twitter, at Chris the Hoff, and I'm at Chris Slate. Hoff has a really cool blog called Still Playing with Power, which you can find at christhehoff.tumblr.com. And you can email us for anything at powerprospod@gmail.com. And if you love the podcast, we'd always appreciate you dropping by iTunes and giving us a rating.
Thanks for listening, everybody. For myself, Chris Slate.
See ya.
And our gaseous pal, Wario. We will see you next time.